You're listening to Irish Radio, Canada's Home and Abroad, and something for your calendar, Saturday the 28th of March, 2 p.m, and that will be in Ottawa. David Wilson, the Professor of History and Celtic Studies at the University of Toronto, will be giving a lecture on focusing on the migrants, how genealogy has transformed our understanding of the Irish in Canada. And it is under the auspices of the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa and the Irish Genealogical Research Society. David, great to connect with you as always.
It's great to be with you again.
Because I have to say straight off, for an historian, you're a fun guy.
Well, thank you. We usually specialize in spoiling good stories. That's one of our specialties. And making primary sources that are really fascinating as dull as possible. We specialize in that, too.
Right. Because you turn history into something worth hearing and listening about rather than something to run away from.
Well, thank you. I ran away from it at school, Austin, believe me. But at university, I realized I saw how it could be done.
Right. So your topic on this one is you're focusing on the migrants, genealogy, and how it has transformed our understanding of the Irish in Canada. The Irish in Canada go way back. I understand that we're looking at the probably 1500s before the first arrivals. Or around that time, the first arrivals would have been in Newfoundland, which was long before Newfoundland became part of Canada. But when the Irish then started to arrive in Canada, from a genealogical perspective, what would have been early 1800s or earlier?
Yes, really after the Napoleonic Wars, from sort of 1818, 1820, that's when it really gets going. Absolutely, yes.
And of course, from a genealogist's point of view, the record keeping in Ireland was a total disaster, but the record keeping of people arriving, be it from ships' logs or other things, was detailed.
Well, yes and no. Actually, the ship logs aren't always as detailed as you'd like, and the records in Ireland aren't as bad as you might think. You know, I know many of them were lost during the opening phase of the Civil War with the attack on the forecourts. But there are a lot of parish records that remain extant, and historians have been able to mine those. So the Irish sources are actually very usable, and you can do a lot with them.
And then tying that to what you would find on the Canadian side, lots of times there can be total misinformation from what somebody provided leaving and the misinformation from what they provided on arrival. So putting two and two together to arrive at the correct answer can be a challenge.
Yes, that does happen. You find cases where people not only change the dates of their arrival, but they also change their names as well. I mean, there aren't many cases of that, but, you know, you're in the new world and you can reinvent yourself. So that does happen. But for the most part, you can get, if you work hard enough at it, as genealogists have done, you can get pretty good lines of connection between areas such as North Tipperary, and say the Ottawa Valley on the one hand and the area around London, Ontario, on the other, as Bruce Elliott has done. I mean, what he did was take 775 families who emigrated from North Tipperary and traced them through. And he found out that this really began with an assisted migration scheme in 1818 involving very small numbers of migrants, or relatively small numbers of migrants, who went to Bytown, Ottawa, present-day Ottawa. And then some of them moved up the valley, and others moved to West Ontario in the London Biddulph area. And that those areas became magnets for subsequent migration. And it's a classic pattern of chain migration, that the most significant predictor of where migrants will wind up is where their kin networks, the people before them, wound up. That's what will happen. And they will either get established in the immediate area of earlier migrants, or they will move into adjacent areas. So this is the pattern that was discovered. But I'd actually like to just move back a little bit and give you a broader sense of how genealogy has transformed our understanding of the Irish in Canada, because it's a fascinating story. So in the 1960s and 1970s, social history was very much front and center of historical work in general. And when applied to Canada, it meant that a lot of historians quite legitimately focused on the Irish in urban areas. They had a very significant presence in Quebec, Montreal, Toronto, Kingston, Cobourg, Toronto, Hamilton. So those were the places where historians focused their attention and their energies. And what they found was that the Irish Catholics were overrepresented in the unskilled laboring classes. And so the conclusion was very quickly made that the Irish in Canada were generally working class Catholic laborers who lived in urban areas. So this view became sort of a standard interpretation, and it seemed to fit very well with American studies of the Irish congregating in Boston and New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and so on. But then in the early 1980s, the perspective, historians tried a new perspective, a new angle of vision, which was rather than focusing on the place on geopolitical units like cities and towns and looking at the Irish there, why not focus on the migrants themselves and shift your perspective? And once you do that, a very different picture emerges of the Irish in Canada. One of the first studies of this was done by two historians, Darrick and Ornstein, a study of the relationship between ethnicity and occupation. And what they found was that most of the Irish migrants to Canada in the core period between 1815 and 1870, when, I should add, the Irish outnumbered the Scots, Welsh, and English combined in Canada, in that core period, a majority of the migrants were actually Protestant, and a majority of Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants alike didn't live in cities. They lived in the countryside, and they did relatively well. I mean, in general, Protestants did better than Catholics for understandable historical reasons, but not greatly so. So this was transformative, and it also opened the way for genealogical studies, because once you focus on the migrants themselves, who are the people best equipped to do that and to follow migrants through from their place, from their point of departure to the place of settlement, to the occupations, and then to go through the next generation and the generation after that, how much social mobility was there? So this brought together historians and genealogists. And I have to say, Austin, before that happened, historians tended to look down on genealogists because historians were interested in big issues and genealogists were interested in minutiae. And also, just at a practical level, if you're an Irish Canadian historian and you're going to the National Library of Ireland and you've only got limited access to micro readers back in the 70s and 80s, and you've got lots of North Americans tracing their family tree, you get very frustrated with them. We're doing serious research. You're just looking up your family tree. So there was a great deal of snobbery involved here on the part of historians. And I'm happy to say that that historians now increasingly realize, as one of them, Donald Akinson, put it, this view was absolute rubbish. His words, absolute rubbish, that genealogists and historians can work together in all kinds of creative ways. So I give in my talk three case studies of this. And one I alluded to briefly, and that was Bruce Elliott's study, which was done way back in 1988 on before digitization. It's truly remarkable work of historical research, looking at parish records, looking at landholding patterns, following migrants through from North Tipperary to, as I mentioned, London and the Ottawa Valley. And then on from there, where when the land runs out in those parts of Ontario, what happens in Tipperary? Well, it's post-famine, for one thing. So think for those who survived, the middle-class farmers, the ones most likely to emigrate, they're doing better in Ireland now. But also new land is opening up in Australasia. So you find in the mid-1850s that the movement from North Tipperary to Canada dwindles, and the movement from North Tipperary to Australia and New Zealand begins to kick in. So you get all kinds of things like this that you discover. Now, another case study that I look at is a very recent one completed last year by one of my friends and colleagues at the University of Toronto in the Celtic Studies program, Mark McGowan, who looked at famine orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And many Canadians will know the famous Heritage Minute of Molly Johnson being allowed to keep her name. Well, Mark McGowan goes through that like a wrecking ball. He demonstrates that most of the famine orphans were not actually adopted, and many of them weren't even orphans, as it turns out. But the vast majority were treated as indentured servants, and probably were treated pretty harshly. Rather than this being a feel-good story, it was one in which famine orphans were treated as cheap sources of labor by by farmers. That's among many of the other findings that he made. But again, it's a really significant piece of research, not only looking at the famine orphans, but with a team of University of Toronto students that Mark McGowan worked with, tracing them through. What happened to them? We don't know in most cases, but we do know in a good number of cases what became of them. So you can get a bigger picture. And then the third case. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to New Ross and seen the famine ship there, the Dunbrody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, the Dunbrody features in this story. Laura Smith, an historian, did her PhD at the University of Toronto, discovered a really interesting cache of sources related to the famine. Now, this consisted of travel receipts from those government agents who took destitute famine migrants to their locations in Ontario, because the government wanted them out of the cities. It did not, I mean, if you think of Toronto during 1847, population 22,000, there were some 38,000 migrants passing through in 1847, extraordinary number. So get them out of the cities into the countryside, and preferably with relatives who'd been there earlier. So you get the transportation receipts, and you get accounts of how much baggage they had, where they came from, what boats they were on, and where they wound up. And it's very interesting. Most of the ones that she found were Protestant, which was counterintuitive, but also part of a broader pattern. Most famine migration, I have to say, was overwhelmingly Catholic. In 1847, probably 90-95% of the migrants were Catholic. But she found all sorts of. She actually got a group of genealogists to work with her, and they tracked these families. And I want to tell you about one such family. I think you'll be really interesting. They were the Rathwells, and they came to Canada from County Carlow. And they sailed on the Dunbrody out of New Ross. And they arrived in Quebec on 3rd of June, 1847. So that's sort of the worst year of the famine. Now, you know, a replica of the Dunbrody is now in the harbor at New Ross. And interestingly, it's used, and you've been there, I think, so you know, it's been used to illustrate the conditions facing emigrants on the coffin ships. That's how it's described. And it's incorporated into the story of Irish immigration, not to Canada, but to the United States. And the exhibition closes with an American Hall of Fame featuring, and I quote now from the site, the large number of Irish Americans who have made significant contributions to our world. The Kennedy dynasty, Henry Ford, Georgia O'Keeffe, Eugene O'Neill, James Watson, Grace Kelly. Now, this is very ironic because this is all centered on a ship that was actually built in Quebec that took immigrants to Canada in 1847 and that had a record as being one of the safest ships on which to cross the Atlantic. The death rate on the Don Brody was one of the lowest of all transatlantic crossings. And the Rathwells wound up in a farm in Innisfil Township near the shore of Lake Simcoe. They wrote a letter to the captain after they arrived, thanking him for the good treatment they'd received. And they named their farm Don Brody. And they never forgot the date of their arrival. And Austin, 100 years later, on 3rd of June, 1947, multiple generations from the U.S. and Canada met and celebrated at the Don Brody farm. And without genealogists, we would never have known.
You mentioned, while you're talking in that period, as you know, we've just come off the 200th anniversary celebrations of the Robinson migration to around the Peterborough area. And likewise, the families that were brought in both from, well documented on both sides, on the Irish side and on the land that they were given on the Canadian side. And one of the things I've noticed recently, and very recently in Ireland, was that there was a nationwide, RT did a nationwide program on that celebration. And there's a growing awareness in Ireland of the Irish-Canadian connection and how deep and how strong it is, not even relative to famine, but pre-famine, how strong it is. And as a result, the names in and around Peterborough, Druro, and all those places, how they come from in and around the Mitchelstown, Kilmallock, all that area.
Yes, that's right. And I'm glad you highlight the pre-famine migration, because this is something else that distinguishes Irish-Canadian migration patterns from those of Irish-American migration patterns, because most of the migrants who came to Canada came before the famine, and most of those who came during the famine went straight through. Those who survived, of course, because the death rate was grim, but those who survived generally moved on to the United States. It's very interesting, actually, in Bruce Elliott's study, in the area around London and Biddulph, Black Donnelly territory, for those who know, in that area, famine migration made no difference whatsoever to the Catholic-Protestant balance in the region, which is interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. But the pre-famine migration was central. And again, in the American case, there's not only massive migration during the famine to the United States, but it keeps going. It keeps going, keeps going. So you're getting a constant renewal of generations right up to the First World War. In Canada, it's very different. Irish migration dwindles from the mid-1850s. So you're looking at a very different ethnic picture now.
David, I'm hopeful that I will be sitting in the audience to listen to you as you present this to a live audience on the 28th of March. And that will be at the Knox Presbyterian Church in Ottawa, 120 Lisgar Street. The doors are opening at 1:30 p.m. And I understand also the lecture will be available to watch online, but you need to register for that. And the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa, their website is bifhsgo.ca. And that's the initials of the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa. So it's bifhsgo.ca. David, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been great chatting with you and learning more.
Always enjoy chatting with you, Austin, and keep up the great work.